From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father Mitch Pacwa. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Wednesday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Pedro Quiles, producing the program. Your call screener is Ace McKay and Michael McCall, handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host is here every Wednesday, Father Mitch Pacwa. How are you?
Groovy.
Got some emails over there?
I do. Want me to answer them?
Take a swing.
Okay. Let's start off with Randy, who asks, in Numbers 12, when, and just to back, for the background of this.
That's right. If you look, that's right after Numbers 11.
Yes. Some of these kids' educations, I swear, they must have gone to public school. So at any rate, yes, but the issue at hand was
Ryan.
That Miriam.
Ryan is the name you were looking for,
yes,
earlier.
Yes, that the reason, what's going on in Numbers 12 is that Miriam and Aaron were envious of Moses' position as the leader. And he... that they try to rebel against him. And in that episode, Miriam was punished with leprosy, but Aaron, who was just as guilty, was not. And when she's struck with leprosy, Aaron asks that, you know, she be healed and to ask Moses to pray for her. So the question is, why is Miriam the only one punished and not Aaron as well? The reason, Randy, is that if Aaron had also gotten leprosy, then he would not be allowed to be the high priest. He would be unclean and would have to cease being high priest. Now, he was punished down the road, truly down the road, when he died well before the people conquered any of the land, and well even before they got into the Holy Land. So that's why he got punished later, but at that immediate moment, it would have made him ritually unclean and unable to be priest. That's why that was going on. And then Billy says, how should I tell my Protestant friend about purgatory? Well, one of the things I would say, Billy, you know, it's something outside of their realm. But there was a great comment by a Protestant from England back in the 1700s, who said, you know, most people are not so good when they die that they really deserve heaven. And most people are not so bad that they deserve hell either. And he recognized the wisdom of this. Now, that may be a way to start. And a second issue for a lot of non-Catholics is to make the distinction between Forgiveness of sin and remission of punishment. A lot of people put those together, but they don't always go together. Good example would be David sinned with Bathsheba in the second book of Samuel. I believe it was chapter 10. And then after committing adultery with her, had her husband drawn to a dangerous part of battle so he'd be killed. And basically, his orders were an order to murder her husband, who was innocent of any crime at all. And he then was confronted by a prophet. The prophet said, you know, that you're the guilty one and this punishment will happen. And David repented and he was forgiven. But the punishment still happened. There still was strife within his family. So, fitting the crime, one of his sons raped a half-sister. The full brother of that woman killed his half-brother who did the rape. And that was Absalom that did that. And Absalom later led a revolt against David. And he had relations with David's concubines, which was the punishment that had been said by the prophet to King David. And so he was forgiven, but he still experienced the punishment. And that may be a help to a Protestant friend because it's in the Bible. And the question then is, what about after death? Well, the third point I would bring to your Protestant friend is that Jesus died and his soul went to the prison where there were the spirits of all the people who had died before his death on the cross. And he preached to them so that they could go to heaven. That's in First Epistle of St. Peter, chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. You may want to go there. I wouldn't start with that one. Start with the others. And you can also see that that's called the prison rather than purgatory, but it's a place for the souls. And then our Lord said, make up with your enemy before you come to court, or else you'll be handed over to the jailer, and the jailer will put you in the prison until you pay the last penny. And using the same word for prison that 1 Peter 3 uses for the place of the souls. So, and I'm not the first to put that together. That was combined to explain purgatory in the early church by the third century is the first time I know of that being pulled together. So that's a very important part. Okay? And then Carl asks, is there a difference between the Septuagint and the old Hebrew Bible? The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. So there's one difference is language. And it was a translation from Hebrew to Greek for Jewish people who lived in Egypt and spoke Greek and didn't know Hebrew anymore after they'd been there for a couple generations, just like immigrants here. Most Jewish people in America no longer can speak Yiddish. Most of them don't read Hebrew, most of them. They might know a few words, but not much. But they read English just fine. That's what they did. So it would be like the difference between the English translation and the Hebrew Bible. Now, is there a difference in the number of books? there's a difference from the number of books that the Pharisees had. The Pharisees eventually decided on 39 books in their canon, while the Septuagint has 46. In the earliest copies we have, the only copies we have, in fact, and so of a complete Septuagint. So that's another difference. And then one other slight difference in the Septuagint, they count the commandments a little bit differently than in Hebrew. So we Catholics use the Septuagint counting for the Ten Commandments, and Protestants use the Hebrew one.
833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Wednesday with Father Mitch.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
You know, one of the great joys and privileges that we have, those of us who work here at EWTN, is the opportunity to pray with our listeners and for our listeners and viewers. We've been doing it for over 40 years, and today we want to pray for anything that weighs on your heart. You know, it can be family members, it can be your health, finances, anything. It's our honor, truly it is, to pray for you. Please take a moment now and send us your prayer requests at ewtn.com/prayer. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number, a rarity on a Wednesday. Some open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. First up today is Joseph in the great state of Nevada, watching us on YouTube today. Joseph, you are on with Father Mitch.
Hi, can you hear me?
Just fine.
Father Mitch, good?
Yeah. So what's your question?
I have two small questions. I think you'll be able to answer them in a decent time. Please, anybody listening, do not be offended. All right, so I'll give you a background of who I am. I'm a Maronite Catholic, Eastern Rite. First thing I want to say is I absolutely, as a Catholic, I want to know, am I a bad Catholic for thinking that priests should be able to get married after ordination? I serve in the church. I would want to be a future deacon. And, you know, I just think that celibacy, I think for some people it works, for some people it doesn't. I just think that, you know, it's a BS rule, in my opinion, and I want to know, am I a bad Catholic for believing that? Now, my second question is, Father Mitch, because I've heard Pope Leo speak on the whole Easter thing with the Eastern churches, when do you think we're going to have a consensus on that, and what do you think will end up being the solution? Like, what do you think will end up being agreed upon based on your predictions?
Sure. Let me take the second question. That's a little bit easier. Right now, the Greeks and the Catholics use two different calendars. One, the Greeks use the calendar of Julius Caesar, and we use the calendar, the correction of the calendar that was made by Jesuits in the 16th century under Pope Gregory. And it's an improved, by far, an improved calendar over, because they could do more observations, but that's okay. And here's the compromise that I've been seeing in the Kingdom of Jordan that they're experimenting with, that the Greeks will celebrate Christmas on December 25th with the Catholics. And then the Catholics celebrate Easter on the date according to the Julian calendar. And that's been, that probably is going to be the way that this compromise works out. And it's not a bad compromise. And, you know, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything sinful about using either calendar, but the Eastern churches are still, they don't want to change the calendar because this was what was used at the time of the apostles. So they now they still calculate by the same reckoning as we, except the calendar is different. And, you know, the Julian calendar isn't quite accurate because the year is 365.28 days. And not, that's why leap year isn't even enough of an adjustment because it's a little bit longer than 20.25. And over the centuries, that ends up adding up. So that's why. But if I think that would be one way. Now, as far as, you know, dealing with celibacy, you know, I maybe you'll get in trouble for calling it a bologna sausage approach, if that's what you meant. But what I think to have a little bit balance on this, in the Maronite Church, we have married clergy. One of the married deacons in my parish is preparing for ordination next year. But as you may know, the eparchy is also slowing this process down, right? Or are you aware of that?
I did not know that they were trying to go to the Western practice of...
Well, they're not trying to go to the Western practice. It's just that they're slowing down a bit on having... But there are a number of men who are married deacons who are being ordained to the priesthood. There's a couple in Dallas that are friends of mine, and I have no objection to it. But there are practical, and this is one of the things that is very important to consider. In a number of the other Eastern churches, we have married Catholic priests. And it doesn't get rid of problems. It changes what your problems might be. And that's something you have to keep in mind. To be realistic about this, I was blessed. I consider it a blessing. I studied in three Protestant seminaries. I took Greek and Hebrew first in the introductory courses at a Lutheran school, advanced Greek and Hebrew at a Presbyterian school, and I got my PhD at a Methodist school. And I became friends with a number of the ministry students in all three, and I really cherished their friendship. They're great folks. But they also gave me a window into the problems of married clergy, including a fact, something a lot of folks don't realize. Even though in these churches, they have married clergy, they have women clergy, and all sorts of other issues that they go open up to, still, they don't have enough ministers. Were you aware of that? That celibacy...
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, celibacy does not make or break. Like, all of a sudden, if you let their get rid of celibacy, it'll, you know, open up the gates and everything. No, because there are other issues at stake. One of the issues is a lot of ministers leave the ministry in their 40s because that's when their children start going to college and they don't make nearly enough as a minister to support the college education of one a child in college, especially these days. And this is back in the 80s when college was relatively cheap. When I went to Vanderbilt, it was only $4,300, $4,200 a year. Now it's $80,000 a year. That's way more than most ministers can afford. They don't get paid an enormous amount of money. And when you, if we started to have a married clergy, you would have to at least quadruple the wages of the clergy. And you probably should quintuple it, because they may have more than two kids. Most likely they would. This is, and even then, it would be very difficult to support a family. You also have to pay attention, and this was a tension I saw in the Protestant ministers. If they were not homeschooling their children, then they ran into difficulties, because children have their free days on Saturday and Sunday. For people in ministry, Saturday is for weddings, Sunday is for the Sunday services. So the days when your kids have off, the minister does not. And that makes it difficult to spend time when you're just hanging out with your family. Their free days and your free days are not the same, except in the summer. So you run into these problems, and then you also had, and I saw this plenty. This is modern times, and a number of the wives had no interest in being the auxiliary pastor of the parish. Used to be that the minister's wife would run the choir, the Sunday school, and other things. And now they have their own careers with little interest in doing those other tasks. So you used to get two for one when you hired a minister and he was married. And they both work for the church. Now you may get one, but what happened? And this was a good friend of mine. His wife had a job in one city making four times as much as the minister, and he had a job 100 miles away. He was assigned to a parish 100 miles away. What do you do? Well, they got a house 50 miles from each one's work, and they end up having the daughter in childcare because they were just going two different directions. Do you see? These are practical issues every married couple has to deal with. But in the ministry, there are a lot of extra struggles. So it's not so easy. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. But there are struggles that the married clergy do have. And one of the strongest advocates I ever met for a celibate clergy was the wife of an Anglican minister who became a Catholic priest. And she strongly was in favor of a celibate clergy because of the strain it put on her and her family, because her husband was a Catholic priest and an Anglican minister before that. So keep in mind, these are practical issues. I have a little bit more freedom with my time, and you know, and I can accept a lot less wage and other issues because I don't have a family. And I can take more risks than if I had a family. So these are some of the issues that you have to keep in mind. Does some of that make sense, Joseph?
Just to clarify this, and for anyone listening, I am not against the celibate clergy.
Right, no.
I agree with all the points you made.
Yeah. I'm I didn't think you were, but I'm also pointing out that if we did have the option for more married clergy, we'd also have other difficulties. So again, it's a matter of, you're not going to get rid of your problems. You change what the problems become.
833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Wednesday with Father Mitch.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner celebrating an incredible 21 years as an EWTN radio affiliate. Living Bread Radio has three stations serving Mother Angelica's hometown of Canton, Cleveland and Youngstown, Ohio. Congratulations to one of my heroes in the Catholic faith, Barb Gaskell. Her team at Living Bread Radio, she also runs a she's got her hand in so many different Catholic pots. She runs a beautiful bookstore there in Canton where the studios of Living Bread Radio are located. She's very, very involved in Mother Angelica's history there in Canton, Ohio. And she is legendary in the world of American Catholicism in our present age. So congratulations to Barb Gaskell and her whole team at Living Bread Radio from all of us here at EWTN Radio. Back to the phones we go. Next up is Ryan in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Ryan, you're on with Father Mitch.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What can we do for you this fine day?
Thank you so much for taking my call, Father.
Sure.
I'm a candidate for the Catholic Church. God willing, this Easter I will be in full communion. Mm-hmm. One thing that I'm going through right now is the annulment process. Uh-huh. My forever spouse and I were both married previously, and I got a notification from the Archdiocese Tribunal yesterday that in my case, I was born and raised Jewish. Because I was not baptized growing up,
mm-hmm.
they had mentioned that there might be something that was a little more expedient in lieu of an annulment. I was hoping you could explain a little bit more about that. And if you have the time, I guess I'd just like some spiritual guidance on what I can do between now and the start of OCIA and becoming Catholic. And I thank you both very much. God bless you.
Sure, sure. A couple things, Ryan. There's something, it's called the Petrine Privilege.
Pauline Privilege.
Petrine is for unbaptized Gentiles. I thought that the Pauline was the unbaptized Gentiles, and Petrine was unbaptized Jewish people. Yeah, I think there are two things. One is the Petrine, one the Pauline Privilege. This allows for remarriage, divorce and remarriage, if you were not baptized. And this is a very, very old, I mean, I remember knowing about this back in the 50s when I was a little boy. And it's been around for, since Peter and Paul. And so that fits for you. I don't know about your spouse. If your spouse was a baptized Christian and got divorced and wants to remarry, then the annulment process is necessary, because we recognize Christian marriages as sacramental, whereas we recognize Jewish and non-Christian marriages as legitimate marriage, but not as sacraments of Jesus Christ.
So, just for the interest of clarification,
yes,
the Petrine Privilege is a concept in Catholic canon law that allows the Pope to dissolve a valid natural marriage between a baptized and an unbaptized person, primarily for the benefit of the baptized individual's faith.
Yes.
The Pauline Privilege is a provision in Catholic canon law that allows for the dissolution of a marriage between two unbaptized individuals one spouse converts to Christianity and desires to remarry in the church.
So in the case of Petrine, one person was not baptized, the other one was. Pauline Privilege, neither was baptized. And again, it's a natural marriage and a gift. You know, we recognize marriage as a gift, as we say in one of the prefaces for marriage, that this was the one gift that was not lost after Adam and Eve sinned. Now, a couple things that in terms of your own growth as you prepare to enter full communion with the church. There are so many wonderful links between Judaism and Catholicism that you would do well to study. Brent Petrie has a book on the Old Testament roots of the Mass. I did a book called The Eucharist, a Bible Study for Catholics. And I make a number of links between Judaism and Catholicism. For instance, some links between the way the high priest on Yom Kippur was kept awake all night by the younger priests so that he wouldn't fall asleep. Whereas Jesus, the high priest in Gethsemane, is trying to keep the younger priests awake during his night of vigil before the Christian Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement being the crucifixion. I think for it would be a very rich thing for you to examine the depths of those links, because what I always tell people who become Catholic after having been Protestant or people who are Jewish, you don't reject that past, but rather you bring it with you and see a completion. And even in some of the Christian prayer, the masses, the mass prayers, you know, when the priest does the offertory in the Roman Rite, he says, "Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this bread to offer." Clearly based and modeled on the Bercha, the blessing of bread and the blessing of the wine in Judaism. To see the dialogue, "The Lord be with you and with your spirit. Lift up your hearts, lift them up to the Lord. Let us give thanks, the Lord is right and just." That comes from the Friday Sabbath service. When there's a minyan, you're allowed to say that, followed by the holy, holy, holy. And to look for those links and see how you're maintaining your Jewish roots and bringing them to a perfection in the Mass. That would be something I would recommend very strongly. There's a man, I think his name was Isaac Goldstein, who became a Catholic back in the 1930s. David was his first name. He wrote a book to Mr. Isaacs about Catholicism and Judaism. It's an old book, and you'd have to look around for an old copy, but it's very worthwhile to get a hold of that. And again, see more of some of these links. Does that...
The Goldstein letters?
That sounds right.
Yeah
that's
David Goldstein.
Yeah, that it's been about...
He's a convert not only from Judaism, but from socialism as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
So does that sound helpful, Ryan?
Father, that was beautiful. I am fortunate enough in St. Louis, we have the Association of Catholics.
That's right.
Mother Miriam's brother.
Right. David yes.
Moss.
Yeah. And they might have some of that material. That would be worth looking at. And in St. Louis, you may want to even go to Maronite liturgy now and again and see how Aramaic, the language of Jesus and the apostles, is still incorporated into the liturgy. So that may be useful to you as well.
God bless you, Ryan. We'll keep you in our prayers as you continue your journey. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still a couple of open lines and time for your calls at 833-288-3986. Alice is in the great state of Michigan listening on Ave Maria Radio. Alice, thanks so much for holding. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I had a question for Father.
Yes.
My daughter is consecrated.
Okay.
And the last 10 years after the founder was removed, I notice now that only with my daughter that she goes everywhere with the same consecrated. And before, they always had strict rules where you buried a different person all the time. And they do work together, and they do both have the same kind of area where they do work, but it really irritates me, and I don't say anything, but I'm wondering, I'm irritated at the household that allows it, why they don't say something, why they don't say, hey, let's go back to our way before, and a different person every time when she comes home, bring a different consecrated from the house.
Yeah. I don't know nearly enough about the exact situation, because I'm sure they have some sort of rule?
Well, they used to. They used to. My younger daughter, who was also in the order, said, you know, they are really strict. We always have a different person on the road team with us. And they had safeguards for emotional attachment.
Yeah.
And now that's kind of not being addressed in this situation anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not happy with it.
Yeah. Do you sense something not being quite right among them?
Our whole family senses too much of an emotional attachment with the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if there's a superior. Is there a superior in the community?
There used to be in every household someone, and then before ahead of them, another person, then ahead of them, another.
Right.
I think now there's basically just the directress in one of the capital cities.
Yeah, it sounds like there is a breakdown in their structure, because I would normally recommend that you go to their local superior, but it sounds like that's also
the removal
down.
Of a founder is always a rugged road.
Yeah, that's not so good. You may want to talk. It sounds like you're gonna have to have at some point a talk with your daughter, and or perhaps with the superior, and just challenge them about this, because you don't, you know, one of the things we never want to see is a really good beginning turn sour for some reason, where who know? I don't know anything about the community. I don't know which community it is, which is fine. I don't need to know, and I don't particularly want to. But what you may also want to do, if this is a community that is under a diocesan foundation, that basically they're headed by one of the local dioceses, which it sounds like it may be, you may want to go to them and express your concern, so that, you know, because usually it doesn't sound like they're being open with everybody who is properly in charge. That may need to be opened up, and so that people who are someone who is responsible. You know, the church doesn't just have orders free-floating around normally. And if they are, that's usually not a good sign. You want to get the proper authorities to get involved, so that, you know, if there is something problematic or that develops in an abusive way of any kind, of any of the vows, obedience or whatever, that gets nipped in the bud. I would definitely try to find out who is actually in charge, and if it is a diocese, get them involved. If not, then the superior. But that does sound like you have to address this.
God bless you, Alice. A lot of our listeners will keep you and your daughter in our prayers. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still have some time for your calls at 833-288-3986. You know, Father Mitch, we as Catholics and many of the Christian faithful invest a lot of time and energy in the pro-life movement.
Yes.
And in that, spend a lot of time working against the scourge of abortion, as well we should. But there are issues at the other end of life,
yes,
that need to be dealt with as well. And you've got a couple of gentlemen, Nicholas Nickus and Bruce Green, are going to talk about that tonight with you on the program.
Yeah, they've written a very helpful book with lots of very practical information as well as solid spiritual insight into the issue of end of life. And they make a great point in the book. Thinking about the end of your life, which is closer for some of us than it is for others. I'm pretty sure I'm closer to my death than I am to my baptism. Unless I live to be 150. I don't think so, though. And so, given that, it's not morbid to think about end of life, but to have a good preparation for the end of life issues. And that would be something that they would help us with. I think it would be a good discussion. I met with them a little bit earlier, and I think they're very, very useful here.
That's EWTN Live with Father Mitch Pacwa tonight, 8 Eastern Time, right here on EWTN Radio and Television. Next up is Gloria in Midland, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Gloria, you're on with Father Mitch.
Oh, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I have a question. How can you explain to someone when Jesus was, you stayed behind and was found in the temple later by Joseph and Mary, he was not being disobedient or committing a sin of disobedience because he was not capable of sinning. But how do you explain to someone?
Okay, a couple things. First of all, had Mary and Joseph ordered him to, you know, to not stay in Jerusalem? I mean, there's nothing that we know of in that line. So he had not disobeyed them. But he, and this is one of the things that comes up later on in the gospel. He also was very clear that he had to be about his Father's business, that his priority is the work of his Heavenly Father. And this comes up in that Gospel of Luke and the other Gospels, that, you know, no one who loves mother or father, brothers or sisters or wife or children more than me is worthy of me. He calls for always putting God first. And as we see in the first commandment, that he says the first commandment is to love the Lord your God with your whole heart, mind, and soul, and secondly, your neighbor as yourself. And he is just as surprised that they didn't start looking for him in the temple. He says, did you know I had to be about my Father's business? That, you know, that he's surprised at them, and they're surprised at him and perplexed. And notice, you know, that Our Lady, as mentioned in particular, stored these things up, and she's considering them. She doesn't fully understand, but these are things that she has to consider, and she doesn't say, I don't care what you say, young man, you're going to get it. No, she doesn't. She recognizes there's another priority that he has.
Very much like the Annunciation, huh?
Very much so.
Same attitude.
Very much so. So I don't think there's a matter of disobedience there. All right.
Next up, we'll stay in the Republic of Texas. Mary is also listening on Guadalupe Radio today. Mary, you're on with Father Mitch.
Hello, Father. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Is there any validity to preserving blessed grapes, a supply, a six-month supply per person, to eat one each day in case of times of food shortage or famine? I have a friend who is urging me to do this. She said she has a blessed grape, and I said, I need more information. What is this all about?
Yeah.
You ever heard of that?
Never.
Neither have I.
I've never heard of that. You know, and I grew up with, blessing of foods for Easter and things like that, but I never heard of blessed grapes. Yeah, I would find out from her, where is this coming from? What you don't have to tell me the exact place, but what part of Texas are you in?
The Dallas area.
Oh, well, that's not a particular grape growing area, is it?
No, but we have lots of grapes from on the grocery shelf.
Yeah, good. So do we.
Yeah.
I can see, like, down in Fredericksburg and that area, Kerrville, they have a lot of vineyards down that way. But not Dallas. So I don't know where that's coming from. I would ask this friend of yours to explain. Tell her, Lucy, you have some splaining to do, because I've never heard of anything like that. Okay.
Thanks, Mary.
Yeah, thanks.
Wish we had some more specific
information. And I'll keep my eyes and ears open for more, but find out. And if you learn anything, let us know.
Mary Ann is in Loveland, California, listening on Catholic Radio Network. I think that might be Loveland, Colorado. Mary Ann, you're on with Father Mitch.
Oh, wow. I didn't think I was going to get through.
Oh, such you did. Are you in Colorado or California?
She's in Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah.
Great. Beautiful. Okay. We got that clear. So what can we do for you?
Well, Father, I have an apostolate. It was confirmed as an apostolate 11 years ago by a priest who was my spiritual advisor,
mm-hmm.
and it concerns child trafficking.
Good for you.
And it's difficult, but, somebody has to be a voice for the voiceless, right?
Yep, yep.
So what I'm asking, Father, my son, who I lost a couple years ago, but he did say to me, Mom, I thought that we as Catholics were all, we were pro-life across the board.
Yes.
You know, everything was pro-life. And I said, yes. And he said, well, why does the church only concentrate and march about abortion? And he said, like with your ministry, why can't that be included as part of the pro-life campaign? Because, Father, these children are dying in child trafficking.
Oh, well, I'm well aware. I think there are two issues. One, we've been overwhelmed with millions of kids being aborted. And so that came up to the front. But then awareness of this human trafficking and of child trafficking has come to us somewhat late. I think a lot of people are blindsided by the reality of so many people. Frankly, a lot of our politicians have been ignoring this, and a lot of the danger that occurs at the border with the illegal crossings included a lot of child trafficking, and people have little or no idea how deadly it is, exactly, but even for the ones who don't die, the scarring on the lives of these young people is horrendous. And I think it calls for another kind of awareness. One, avoidance of pornography, because people have little idea how much it is sexual slaves that are forced into that. And then looking for people who not only care about this issue, but can help take care of the young people, because the psychological help they need is tremendous after their escape.
God bless you and your work, Marianne. Father, would you leave us with a blessing?
Lord, bless you all and keep you, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and have a wonderful and blessed day of independence.
On behalf of our host, Father Mitch Packwood, producer Pedro Quiles, our call screener Ace McKay, and social media maven Mr. Michael McCall, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in to Open Line Wednesday. Father Gerald Murray and Open Line Thursday tomorrow. Until then, God bless.